Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today the focus is on an all-too-familiar story of smaller rural heartland towns that lose its economic drivers have been struggling to maintain its character and viability. There's a lot going on here, and while sometimes the overall narrative can be somewhat negative, there are sprouts of hope that are there. And the town in particular that we're talking about today is the focus of a PBS documentary that was done a couple years ago. And one of the producers is with me today. I'm looking forward to this interview because it's, again, an all-too-familiar story in our region here in the Midwest and Heartland. This town is actually in West Virginia, and it's called Moundsville. And while there's some differences with communities in our immediate areas, it has far more similarities. My guest to discuss this town and others like it is John Miller. John, thanks a lot for taking the time.
So glad to be here with you today, Robin.
So give our listeners an idea of what your background is and how you came to focus and do this story on Moundsville and how you selected Moundsville as the topic for your interest.
So my background is I grew up in Belgium. My parents are American. They moved to Belgium in the 70s to play music. My joke is they fled the terror of the Ford administration, but they were just musicians who dropped an anchor. We all grew up in Belgium speaking French. I worked at the Wall Street Journal for a long time. I moved to Pittsburgh in 2011 to cover global mining. After the 2016 election, I really wanted to do something deeper about America. And as somebody who grew up overseas, to me, even though I speak English like an American, America is in some ways a place I'm always discovering. And so in this quest for depth, I came across Moundsville, which is about an hour from Pittsburgh, and which has so many layers of American history. And I'm so glad you pointed out that it has this commonality with a lot of American towns, because it really does. I mean, it's built around a Native American mound, 2,000 years old, that reminds you of all that was here before the United States. And then it has this incredible industrial past where it had the world's biggest toy factory. They made Rock'em Sock'em Robots. They made the big wheel. And now it has, you know, an economy based on a Walmart and a hospital and a Main Street with craft stores and local businesses. And so it's so typical in my mind. So when I went to, you know, wanted to do this deeper piece about America, I thought about Moundsville. And I teamed up with a local filmmaker, Dave Bernabeau, and we spent about a year in 2018 going there. And the movie is an oral history of people in the town telling their story. There's no voiceover. There's no outside experts. It's their story. And again, I think it's a very universal story about America in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, I like the way you phrase that. Always discovering America, rediscovering America, and what it means to be an American and our identity, which we seem to be grappling with right now, I think is at the heart of some of the partisan divide we have. And it's always interesting. I love these types of television shows like you did here, where people are talking and you just get out of the way and let them talk. And it's very well done. And you, another thing I like, and we'll get to this a little more, is you really air both sides of some of these local issues, which is refreshing in today's journalism. But talk a little bit about Moundsville, its size, kind of its some of the demographic features of it, if you would, so people can kind of get an idea of something to compare it to that's near them.
It currently has around 8,000 inhabitants. At its heyday in the 60s, it had 15,000. It's on the Ohio River, which is a main artery of commerce. One thing I discovered making the film was that the Ohio River in the 1950s and 60s, it was like, you know, Manchester in the 1890s or China, Shanghai or Guangzhou province today, where the kind of place where they just make everything. Like, it wasn't just steel and coal. It was like toys and cigars and shirts and shoes. And so if, you know, listeners might want to think about clusters like that, like in America you have, you know, around Detroit or Chicago or, you know, Pittsburgh or parts of Iowa, you have these industrial centers that just make a lot of stuff. And so Moundsville is part of that network of factories and suppliers, and everything was shipped out along the Ohio River to markets in the United States and around the world. And, you know, around the 1980s, it started losing its industries. There's still some stuff left. There's a, we feature a cabinet, a little factory that makes kitchen cabinets in the film. But the kind of big model of, like, big factories that would employ 300,000-500,000 people, you know, they were all, the workers would be part of a union, like, that model has gone away. And so in that regard, again, it's very typical to a lot of towns that have lost, like, the big employer that would employ, like, you know, 2,000 people plus, you know, families could work there for generations, fathers and sons, that kind of thing, was lost 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's very familiar out here. It some of the industries may be different, but the story is the same. And I think you handled the topic of fracking, which, of course, is a big issue out in that area. It's a big extraction area. Maybe talk a little bit about the history of coal mining, but now the impact that fracking is having on the area.
So we, you know, in an hour, a bit over an hour-long movie, we couldn't focus on every issue. So fracking, we didn't focus on the environmental part, which a lot of people talk about, and I know there's issues there. I was more concerned with what it said about employment. And so the issue with fracking is that it's an industry where you have a lot of work up front to design and drill the well, and that typically is done by engineers who are highly skilled, who don't come from the town they're fracking around and in. So in Moundsville, there's a lot of gas wells, but people from Moundsville usually still get hired in these wells. And so once you build the well and turn the tap on, you don't need that many people. It's not like coal where, and there are a lot of coal mines around Moundsville, but in coal, you need a bunch of people to dig it out of the ground. Although now with automation, you know, there's less than 15,000 coal miners left in the state of West Virginia, which is very famous for coal mining. But fracking, again, because of the nature of the industry, doesn't employ that many people. So it's not the kind of panacea for employment. It brings in a lot of in taxes, we point out in the film, and people who come from outside do spend money in the town. But it's not that kind of stable employer that the town, you know, dreams of.
Yeah, and some of the folks talked about you know, the limited impact that it had economically, but it seemed, you know, that they went along with it, just was some type of economic activity. Go ahead.
And there's you know, royalty fees and ground right fees that people who own land with gas get from the fracking. So people do make money in different kinds of ways. And they're basically welcoming almost any industrial activity. I mean, there was just, after the movie was made, like a few months ago, a plastics processing plant which has come into town. And that's kind of the new direction, because fracking has a lot of, or natural gas has a lot of offshoot industries. One of them is making plastics. So along the Ohio Valley, there are a few plastic plants and supply chains based on those that are getting built.
You also deal with the issue of the Walmarts, I think, and get the local folks' reactions to that. And of course, you know, as everybody knows, Walmart has grown, and they're in most towns over a certain population in our region and across the country. A lot of folks feel that they've helped lead to the end of the traditional Main Street, which featured a lot of locally owned businesses. You deal with that issue here as well, in talking to folks, what was kind of the general reaction that folks had there?
So, I mean, they were competing with other towns to get the Walmart. So in some ways they were happy, because that meant they got the 300 or 400 jobs Walmart offered, not in another town. Obviously it helped put a lot of Main Street stores out of business. My favorite thing as a journalist is a lot of things are true at the same time. So it wasn't the only thing that was, you know, making it hard for local business, but it didn't help to have, you know, very cheap stuff made overseas all of a sudden shipped in and competing with you. It was a close vote. In the late 90s, the council was almost split. They voted 4-3 to take the Walmart in, and then it became like a community center. And it's a place where people go to hang out. So I wanted to capture that, too, and capture the complexity of it. And I also wanted to show that, you know, for all of the hand-wringing about, you know, trade deals and the impact of imports, I mean, these are choices that Americans made on an individual level. Like every time somebody wants to buy a cheap pair of shoes at Walmart, you know, that's made in China, you're helping the trade deficit. Like, we should look at ourselves for, you know, the impact of Walmart and what's done to our economy and local business. Like, that's a decision that Americans collectively have made. It's not one person, it's not one big bad ogre who made a trade deal and all of a sudden everybody else got screwed. No, we made this decision collectively to shop at a place like Walmart.
You know, our area, as you know, is, I don't know what the definition would be geographically, but a lot of folks call us flyover country, which is kind of a condescending term, I think. In this county that you're talking about, Marshall County, the percent with college degrees I looked up was right around 10 to 12%. And again, this is the type of place that people look at, down their nose at. But what I was struck by, John, and I find it around here where I live as well, is people take a fairly sophisticated look at both sides of these issues. And you just, again, you got out of the way and let them talk. And I noted that there. Did you find that as well? Were you surprised a little by, you know, getting out of an urban area like Pittsburgh and talking to locals that, you know, there was kind of a keen analysis of a lot of these issues and looking at both sides?
A very thoughtful, very considerate approach to the economy, because they're talking about their own lives, basically. And my big message with Moundsville is that it's just as kind of interesting and kind of deep a place as, you know, Pittsburgh or New York City. But here's one fact about it. It is poorer than a generation ago because of that loss of industrial jobs that paid well. And so people have to deal with that, and it's hard. And in that struggle, though, there is, like, a lot of kind of wisdom that comes with it. And it's not hell. Like, it's a good place to live. Lots of people live good lives in places like Moundsville. But it is poorer, and you have to kind of, you know, reckon with that and sort of highlight, you know, ways in which people are being entrepreneurial and trying to fight back. And that's why I wanted to show, too, that, you know, it's very complex, and there's a lot of people who are doing great things with their lives and are building a new reality after the end of industrial work.
Yeah, it seems like over and over again you see this same story, you know, and you document it. The population is older, it's overwhelmingly white, which I want to touch on in a second, and poor and few college degrees compared with the national average. And the population loss was enormous, what they're showing this last decade, about 1,300 people. But they do have assets. They're on a river, and they've got some other things they're trying to take advantage of. Niche industries, as you mentioned, or other things that are natural to where they're at that they can kind of do to attract people. Tourism seemed to be one area where they're concentrating on.
That's right. Tourism is a big deal because they have the Native American Mound, they have the West Virginia Archaeological Museum and site there. There's a penitentiary which closed in 95 that is kind of legendary and shows up on ghost tourism tours that used to house Charles Manson's mom, and Eugene Debs, the socialist who ran for president, was in prison there. They had a hangings there in the 30s. It was an electric chair. Sort of iconic old-school 19th century prison that attracts a lot of tourism. And, you know, it's a little quirky to market yourself as a place where you can go see ghosts, but I find it very American and very in this kind of vein of, you know, hustling and trying to, like, figure it out and crack the code of making it all work. And I really admire that. I admire people who can take a punch like that. There's a character in the movie who was working at the glass industry, Fostoria Glass, and got laid off. And this was in the 1980s, and he wanted to keep making glass. So he started a little shop, Fred Wilkerson Sr., and with his son, Fred Wilkerson Jr., they now make glass artisanally with this furnace they recovered from the factory, and they sell it online. And so, like, that kind of initiative and entrepreneurialism, I think that's very American. And in a way, like, it's the most American story there is, because we're all subjects of these big economic forces. Like, none of us sort of, you know, invited the computer or invited automation into our lives. We're all just trying to cope. And I think the most American thing is to roll with the punches and do the best you can.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is John Miller, who's a former Wall Street Journal reporter who's produced a movie called Moundsville, which has been on PBS, and very interesting. And a lot of the storylines surrounding this town, people can relate to in our region as well. And that's why I thought it was so interesting, and it's really well done. John, I want to let you mention a minute here, in case our listeners are interested in watching this, where they can see it and kind of your ongoing efforts. Describe that to follow up with the story.
So it's part of the PBS network, so you can see it for free on pbs.org or any app, any Roku app or any kind of way that you watch television. If it's a PBS app, you can find it. Just do a search for Moundsville. Now, there's a blog, moundsville.org, which has a slightly longer cut, like a director's cut of the movie that you can rent for $4. And moundsville.org, which I started as a promotional vehicle for the film, has become like a magazine about wider issues, about Appalachia, about West Virginia, because I find it so fascinating. So I've continued to write about it. I wrote about Jerry West, the NBA basketball great, who's from a small town called Chelly in West Virginia. I've written about Lady Gaga, whose mom grew up in Moundsville. Brad Paisley grew up in Moundsville. George Brett, the baseball player, was born in Moundsville. So all these like connections to America I've been able to write about on the blog. And like yesterday I published a review of a new book by a woman who's Indian and who is gay and who grew up in so-called Chemical Valley near Nitro, West Virginia, and she writes about how much she loves West Virginia. So I also wanted to show how much diversity and how much, you know, cultural complexity there is, even in a place that gets stereotyped as kind of uniform and monochrome. And I wanted to show that, you know, that's very American, too, that there's so much different kinds of people who love the same place, love Appalachia, love West Virginia.
That's a great segue into the next couple questions I had. One of the things that struck me, in the past, whenever I want to learn about communities, I go to the census and look at information, and I found it. Moundsville and the surrounding county are about 95% white, non-Hispanic. But yet one of the major people in this film is an African-American who is mayor. Is he the current mayor? But I'm curious, how in the world, I mean, that goes against every stereotype we have of these communities, but how in the world, when you talk to him, was he able to win that spot?
So his name is Gene Saunders. He's on the council now. He's no longer the mayor.
Okay.
He's a force of nature. He's somebody whose personality kind of overcomes any prejudices. And he grew up with a lot of prejudice. In the 50s and 60s, you know, he was the first person to play basketball and baseball on the local sports teams. And there have never been a lot of, in the recent memory, never been a lot of African-Americans living in Moundsville. His family was part of the Great Migration. They moved north in the early part of the 20th century. His dad found work in a coal mine in West Virginia. Gene worked in the coal mine, and if I have any regrets about the movie, it's that I did do a lot more about Gene because he's such an amazing guy. He worked in the coal mine. He lost part of a leg in the coal mine, and then he's become a town booster, and he's part of the movie. He gives a tour of the town, points out how much he loves the local bakery, which makes the world's, America's best donut, he says. And so he got elected mayor because he's just somebody who overwhelms you with his enthusiasm. He's very patriotic. He loves Moundsville. He loves America. If you look at the town hall and there's a wall of portraits of all the mayors, it's, you know, 47 white faces and then Gene. And so, yeah, he stands out as you know, it's surprising to you. And obviously there's still, you know, racial prejudice in a place like Moundsville. But on a local level, and this is part of the movie's message too, is that on a local level, people see the person. They don't see the kind of systemic narrative. They see their neighbor. They see somebody they trust and love. And so Gene is sort of an example of how at the local level you can have a lot more tolerance and understanding than if things are presented kind of systemically.
You know, there was a quote early on in this film that stuck with me afterwards when I watched it, and I still can remember it. And it was a really powerful comment. It looked like, I believe it was the owner, a young Hispanic male, who owns a restaurant. I believe that's right, and you can correct me. But he talked about the shared struggles that working class have, and that if it wasn't for the fact that he was an immigrant, they all share the same struggles. And I thought that was a very powerful moment that that was shared there, that kind of talks to differences by class instead of by race or ethnicity.
And that's a big thing happening in this country right now, I think, is that people are, you know, the identities and the divisions are becoming more along class lines than along racial lines. And Alexis Martinez is his name, and his family owns the Acapulco, the town's only Mexican restaurant, which, again, is also very typical. I feel like every, you know, small, medium town in America has one or two Mexican restaurants, often operated by a family. So this is, Moundsville has the Martinez family in Acapulco. And so Alexis is very sensitive to that and points that out. He says, you know, if me and a white guy who might have voted for Trump could really talk, we would discover that we would have way more in common than we have differences.
Yeah. Now, I got film, and people may be asking right now, you know, did it get into politics at all? And it didn't. But I have to, because everything's political now. But that was one of the refreshing aspects, is it kind of didn't. But this county went 75% for Trump. I mean, was there any talk there about politics, about ways in which government can help? Or is this all about just kind of lifting themselves up from the bottom up?
So there's a backstory there. I mean, obviously, the motivation to make the film was very much about Trump and national politics and what's happening. And I wanted to do something, again, that was deeper. And we asked everybody at the end of the interview, wait to the end because we didn't want to, you know, annoy anybody. But we'd ask, you know, what are your politics? Did you vote for Trump and why? And their answers, I found, were, you know, with all due respect, not that interesting. They were repeating things they had seen on national TV. And it really struck me, like, they don't really know. Like, they're not in Washington seeing up close what's actually happening. Like, what they know about is their own lives and their work and their parents' work and how things have changed in their town. And that was interesting. So in the end, we just cut all the political stuff. Now, I would say about half the people in the film are voted for Trump. I think it's 50-50 by party. So slightly, you know, or actually a little bit less than in the town. And I would say the support for Trump in a town like that, it's very much based on identity. These aren't wealthy people who are voting for tax cuts. It's people who long for the 50s and 60s to come back in some way. And Trump, with the, you know, Make America Great Again, kind of tapped into that. And, you know, it's also part of the state's change. The state was a very much a union, blue dog Democrat state for a long time because people worked in unions and they supported the Democrats in that way. And because unions have lost their power, you know, that's allowed the Republican Party to come in and Trump to come in with a message of restoration that appeals to people. And so, again, identity politics, I think, are the driver of support for Trump in a town like Moundville.
Has there anything happened since the documentary or the film was made that that have maybe, you know, changed or might have shifted some of the conclusions or some of the comments that were made in the original?
Not really. There's this new plant I discussed. It's a Turkish company which is going to employ around 50 people. There's a talk of a new plant across the river, which would be a plastics processing plant. They call it a cracking plant, and that has not happened yet. I think there's a new hotel. I mean, I get calls. Phil Remke, in the film, his former mayor, will call me and say, like, oh, John, you got to come down. We just have a new Japanese restaurant. So there's a little bit of you know business selling and buying. You know, they're on the river. They're not far from Pittsburgh and Wheeling. So they're a little better situated in some small towns, and there's some remote workers coming in. West Virginia has now offered $10,000 for anybody who wants to go live there. And so Moundville's picked up a few people like that. And there's some younger people in the city council that are trying to build up tourism and the river. So, you know, incremental changes, but the basic story is still the same. And the story I wanted to tell of this transition over time is still very much in action.
I guess when I watch this, and then other communities, I've had authors on. One author wrote a book about Janesville, Wisconsin. We've studied other communities throughout the Heartland region that have suffered similar things, and I'm always. I mean, yeah, I'm heartened by the resilience of people to get up off the mat when they're knocked down. But I can't help but feel frustration and anger that our policy leaders didn't have any more foresight on trade and what happened. A huge adjustment in our economy that pretty much disabled a lot of our manufacturing base. I mean, do you feel that? And people in this film talked about it, but I just feel like, again, that's one of the emotions I have when I'm done is boy, it just seems like we made a pretty big mistake back then.
So I covered global trade for the Wall Street Journal in Brussels and in Geneva, Switzerland. So I would go to these meetings and see like trade deals being carved out at the very highest levels. And so part of my motivation for making Moundville was to say, okay, well, you know, I saw that part of the story, but what happened in these towns? And it's well known that in an economy, I mean, trade creates winners and losers. I mean, basically, you know, we were gambling. We would have the right to sell you know, about cars and with technology in China, and they would get to sell us shoes and shirts. But was very much underestimated. Even very senior policy people in D.C. will say this. I mean, they screwed up. They screwed up in not foreseeing how destructive it would be in places like Townsville and throughout the country, and how much these towns have suffered, how much human capital. I mean, so the Mark Toy plant, which made Rock and Sock and Robots in Townsville, it employed 2,000 people, and you know that included like 200 artists who were, you know, patrons of the local museum and the local theater. And those people all left. Like, all that human capital, all those smart, interesting cultural drivers went to New York or Pittsburgh. And so that, I mean, you know, bleeding of human talent from the hinterlands has been catastrophic, I think, for this country. And it's at the root of all these divisions, I think, and was not foreseen. You're absolutely right. It was not foreseen in all these trade deals. At the end of the day, that Americans endorsed by shopping at Walmart and buying, you know, cheap shoes and television. So I kind of want to say, like in the Pogo cartoon, like, we've met the enemy and he is us. Like, you're right that there was a big mistake here. But I think it's a mistake that we all made with the way of life we chose.
We've got about a minute left here. This may be somewhat of an unfair question, but I want to ask it just to get your thoughts, because I thought of it when I was done, how I felt. But do you feel like your film has a happy ending, or how do you want people to feel after they view it?
That's a very good question. I would say like the title of his book, Jerry West talks, he has this quote, "Life is a tragedy full of joy." And so I kind of feel like there's a tragedy in Moundsville, because people were subject to forces beyond their control, which messed into their community. And it wasn't their fault. And they had to live with that. And they've been fighting back. And so I think there's happiness in the struggle against tragedy. How's that?
That's good. It didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it was just the thought I had I asked other authors of books about these communities, you know, is it a happy ending? And it is. It's tough. There's some good, but there's definitely some bad overall. But I appreciate your explanation.
And one thing, Robin, too, yeah. I add, like, the mound, which is in the middle of town, it reminds you that no period in history lasts forever, that America had this incredible industrial heyday in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And then it ended, and just like the mound, which the Adena people built, I mean, they're gone. And so we have to move on and look towards the future. And we need to grieve this period, and people need our compassion and solidarity. But we're not going back, and so we need to move forward with reality.
Well, I hope our listeners take an interest and maybe look this up and view the film on PBS. It's called Moundsville. Also, John, share the address for the ongoing exploration of this.
So moundsville.org is the website, and everybody can watch it on pbs.org.
Great. Thank you very much for being our guest today.
I appreciate your interest so much, Robin. Thank you.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey, this is Matt.
And I'm Joy.
Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to be a high-powered attorney, marketing guru, or entrepreneur?
If you have, we have a podcast just for you, and it's a real piece of work.
Come on, Joy, it's not that bad.
No, Matt, that's the name, A Real Piece of Work. It's the new job podcast for young people from WVIK and Junior Achievement of the Heartland.
Oh, nice.
Join us for A Real Piece of Work and get a jump start on your future.